Hi, welcome to Inside Learning episode 135 for the 6th of February 2014. A hard road to travel. Welcome to Inside Learning. How are you, Steve?
I'm well, thank you, Matthew. Yes, thanks to the NHS, who, as usual, did a superb job.
You had a little bit of a visit to the doctors last week then, I believe?
Yes, I had a hernia operation, which is quite invasive, but these days is quite minor in the scheme of things.
Yeah, well, I didn't like to say on air, as it were, last week, but I'm sure our listeners missed you greatly. I certainly did, but Bill and Jay did a great job of filling in last week. It was a good cast.
It was a good cast. Yeah, I enjoyed. I was able to lie down in bed and listen to it, so it was always a luxury.
Absolutely. Well, we're joined by yet another fantastic guest this week. We've had a really great run of guests recently, Bruce Robertson. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Matthew. How are you?
Not bad. I'm very, very pleased, Bruce, because I've been haranguing you at various public events for about a year to do this, and it's been my failing not following through, not yours. So it's great to actually get you on board tonight. Very exciting.
No problem. I've been harangued at plenty of public meetings over the years. I can assure you, your haranguing is fine.
Oh, he's got a very good style in haranguing, Bruce. He does it so discreetly.
So for our listeners, Bruce has been is that rare animal, a 2 times director of education in Scotland, first in Highland, where I first met you, Bruce, and then in Aberdeenshire, where I believe you hail from as a private citizen, and now you're professional advisor for ADES, the Association of Directors of Education. Is that right?
Well, I do a bit of work for ADES in terms of just adding a bit of capacity to the association. I've been a member of the association for a long time now, so I give them some policy advice, add a bit of capacity, and I also have a desk in the Scottish Government, where I'm kind of the Scottish Government ADES link, and also advise colleagues in Victoria Quay on a number of things. So life is busy and interesting.
So a fascinating role. Well, we're going to have a wee chat then later about the sort of policy and national leadership side, and looking at middle layers and all those kind of questions. But first of all, let's start with a wee roundup in the news. Steve, I won't ask you about football. I believe last week the guys covered it for you. This is a bad habit of ours, Bruce. We like to see how Steve's team's done just before we move on.
And which team is that, Steve?
Well, I found a fellow supporter in John Macbeth. It's the Arsenal.
I see.
Are you a football fan, Bruce?
Oh, I certainly am. And yes, I had great news this week, because Aberdeen finally reached a cup final again.
Oh,
and,
brilliant.
Down south, Steve, I must say I follow Manchester United and have done for many decades now. But yes, they're having their ups and downs.
Yes. I'm sure Steve will overlook this in the interest of politeness. Well, I really don't know much about football, so that's me done my duty. You haven't said how did they do then, Steve?
The Arsenal,
yeah,
we won 2-0.
Ah,
still top of the league.
Predictable. Oh well, that'll put you in good form then for tonight. You'll be happy. So we won't have any of your curmudgeonly complaints about that nice man, Mr. Gove, tonight then.
Oh, well, I've had a week off, Matthew. I've got to get back into the. Got to get back into the Gove again. So,
do you know what was the best thing about having Meg Russell guest in recently? It was the lovely little moment when he talked about Gove not listening to our advice. The idea of the two of them actually speaking to each other in a room is really quite amusing, isn't it? They're such different characters.
yeah, indeed. No, it's just the story about it calling for state schools to be more like private schools. So I don't know how much traction that got north of the border, but it certainly caused a flurry of comments on the blogosphere.
Oh yeah,
down there.
Yeah, it got a lot of traction right across the country, actually. And quite interesting reactions. I think quite a number of my colleagues, when they're having a really bad day, maybe cast an eye, south of Hadrian's Wall. But there's all sorts of things you could get into there. And actually, from a Scottish point of view, probably a far better barometer is to have a look at what's happening in Wales. And we would be very mindful to just look at the things that are happening there, because obviously they're a devolved nation as well, and there are some very, very big changes going on that perhaps are far, far more synonymous with Scottish conditions than what's happening under Mr. Gove just now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, well, shall we press on, Steve? Are we about to add some more?
No, I was just... just to say that... Well, it just raises so many questions, doesn't it? And I don't know what the average fee for a private school is. It's probably something like 12,000. Somebody calculated on that. And I think the average secondary school in England gets £4,000 a pupil. But I think I don't know whether it does the kind of the idea of the schooling as learning organisations any good when you kind of set up these false dichotomies. Why is he introducing this into the debate?
Even from the point of view of his own PR, and I can sense I'm going down a rat hole here. We must climb back out. I don't think it does him much good, because the danger is he's not taken seriously even in the good ideas that he occasionally may have, if he associates himself too far with that very backward looking model.
I mean, somebody like Anthony Seddon, for example, who's the head teacher of Wellington, one of the top private schools, and was a biographer of Blair. I mean, he said some quite sensible things about having the dialogue with the state sector. And that probably is the sort of voice we want to be hearing in terms of that kind of cultural educational dialogue. But to set up these kind of, it's almost like setting up straw men, isn't it? And these kind of false dichotomies, it just doesn't further the debate at all.
Yeah, that's been a recurring sadness. Anyway, let's press on. So, Bruce, as our guest, is there anything that you've noticed this week that's interested you in the news?
Yeah, I think maybe today, actually. Of course, landmark Scottish budget passed, the budget just before our referendum. Quite interesting that all party other than the Conservative Party supported it. It sets out a fiscal position that, on the one hand, some good news in terms of the bedroom tax, in terms of one specific, but actually what it's establishing is a framework for very serious challenges to the public sector. What's happened, obviously, in Scotland is that we haven't taken the really difficult decisions that perhaps have been taken down in England and Wales, and we are definitely heading for the next 4 years of very, very hard public sector financial agreements. And I think today, just for me, whilst on the one hand, there's a bit of good news there, I think it's important that we temper that with some reality as to what it means over the next 3 to 4 years for us.
Yeah.
Can I just ask a question here, Bruce, about just following on from our conversation with Mike Russell, which I kind of hugely enjoyed, but obviously didn't have much time to question him. He said something about, because obviously he mentioned the Yes campaign, and being able to have more fiscal control in terms of the budget for Scottish schools, and much more autonomy. I mean, I wasn't sure at that point. I mean, don't you have that autonomy already? I mean, would you now have more autonomy with the Yes campaign?
I think what Mike Russell was probably referring to there, because I have heard him talk about that on a number of occasions. Education is a devolved function, so it's entirely within our control, but within the budget that is devolved to Scotland. And I think what the Yes campaign would be saying about that is that if we had our own tax raising powers, then perhaps you can actually set a number of priorities that are clearly different from the rest of the UK. But with that, I mean, that's a double-edged sword as well. But I think that's probably what Mike Russell, where he was coming from with that statement.
Right. Well, thanks for clarifying that. It's useful.
And Bruce, that's timely. I'm sure it wasn't a deliberate segue, but you did write a very, very thought-provoking piece in the Times Education Supplement Scotland this week about, you know, just that topic about our, I think you would have described it roughly as our inability to really grasp the nettle of looking at things like shared services to, you know, to cushion this blow when it comes.
Yeah, I really was trying to provoke a debate, and it's been quite interesting to see some of the responses I've had, almost entirely favourable, positive responses. It's really difficult to affect change in Scotland, particularly in education, for all sorts of reasons. But I do think we're at a point in time now where we need to have a debate on just the whole business of how we're planning and delivering education. We've got 32 local authorities who currently have the education authority function. The history of the 32 authorities goes way back to Thatcher's days, and the makeup is hugely variable. If you think about your neighbour Glasgow, Matthew, compared to your own position in Western Bartonshire, there's a good example of how variable in size things can be. We've also got
you're saying they're bigger than us then, Bruce?
Just a wee bit. I mean, 10% of Scotland, and there's a huge variety and a huge number of challenges there, obviously. But the other thing is, we have a mature Scottish Parliament now. It's been established for well over a decade, and you just need to look at the parliamentary debates and the work of the Scottish Parliament's Education Committee to see the interest that they have in education as well. But I think probably the thing that's brought this to a head is the financial position, and I just don't think it's sustainable anymore. For example, to have 32 different payroll systems, personnel systems, financial systems, IT systems, and in a country of just over 5 million, and that's before we get into the whole business of education policy and so on. So I do think post the referendum, I think we need to have the debate, and particularly about what the role of the education authority in Scotland should be like, and how we support our schools and how the middle tier functions.
Steve, you know what I'm going to say here. For quite a long while, Bruce, we had a sort of creativity exercise once on one of our podcasts. We just played around with some ideas, and I became quite attracted to the idea that we could take education policy making out of politics, whether local or national, and just give it a long time scale, the sort of Bank of England model, you know, whereby you'd say, mm-hmm. you know, we're giving you measures and outcomes, and there'll be, you know, the ones that we value, not just the easy to measure ones. Report to us, you know, let us know mm-hmm. how you're getting on, but we're not going to bat you around in different directions as the political wind changes, you know, to allow, you know, real long term policy making.
I think we started talking this evening about some of the excesses through Mr. Gove, and I think in all seriousness, you know, we're very lucky in Scotland that we've never had that. And you know, in Scotland, there's largely a consensus on the big ticket issues. Yeah. So therefore, you'll see cross party support for the likes of Curriculum for Excellence and the whole business of trying to close the attainment gap for those particularly in disadvantage. I guess, like you, in my past, I've often thought, you know, how do you take politics out of education? But the reality is that it's such an important part of the public sector is such an important thing as far as the legacy and the vision and so on of a country, that I don't think education will ever be removed from politics. But yeah, to set longer term aspirations and longer term targets and be less exercised about inputs and more about, you know, the kind of outputs that we were talking about for youngsters, that I think we should strive towards that.
Okay, so basically a call for us to you know, just be open to rethinking the, you know, the way that we prioritise our spend and that we share services. And I guess what I'm hearing from you there is post-referendum is when that debate will happen then, because politically it's probably not one that people, the government are going to want to have just now.
I don't think any of the parties really want to have that just now. They're very much focused on the referendum campaign, and that's as it should be. But I do think that once we get in, head towards the next Scottish government election and begin to challenge the financial arena that we have, then it's bound to happen. And it's important that we try to influence that debate. As it happens, the Scottish Parliament's just put a call out for some thinking on the priorities for education and cultural services post-referendum. So I think, you know, the die is cast there. And what I would like to do is have a grown-up debate about this, and particularly around the role of the Education Authority, where it should sit, and how we perhaps the national and local education inputs work far more closely together than ever before, so that really we've got a much more joined up and much more efficient and effective service.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay, thanks for that. Steve, can you move us on to whatever you've spotted this week?
Well, my main thing was the Gove thing. I was just coming back, very interested. I mean, I've got a couple of other stories, but I was really interested in what Bruce was saying there about the role for the middle tier, because, of course, in England, that role, which I do think should have a political function, because I do think there should be an element of public accountability at the local level to the communities within which schools operate, and we haven't always got it right in terms of perhaps become over bureaucratized and perhaps a bit removed from communities. But the local, that middle tier in England, is being entirely squeezed out. And what we have is a very political department at the centre, and this kind of nebulous notion of autonomy at local schools. We've got a highly fractured school system. So I think it'd be really interesting to watch the debate north of the border and see what we can learn about how you kind of square the educational support at the local.
Yeah, I think you're right there. I mean, I know you've got a highly fractured system, but I think perhaps what we could learn from yourselves is that let's introduce a bit more innovation into our system. Essentially, education, if you peel it right back, you know, education hasn't changed that much in the last 40 to 50 years in many respects, and perhaps maybe a little bit more freedom to innovate and maybe a signal politically that's fine is what we need. But that's where the challenge is, because we need to be able to take some risks. And I do think the role of the middle tier, as well as supporting schools and obviously trying to improve a lot of children, the role of the middle tier is to try and encourage innovation and a sense of a place of safety.
Yeah. Sorry, did you want? Well, I did have a news story, which is an international one, Matthew, and it's about it comes from UNESCO, about, you know, they have the target for every.
Child of a primary place, is that the one?
Yeah, and they think the target now won't be met till 2086 or something?
Yeah, I saw that a few weeks ago, and
which I think is shocking.
It's a horrible piece of news.
Yeah, but I take more than just a passing interest in that. I'm involved in a small education and skills development charity in West Africa, and it is quite interesting to see just how the other half live. And one of the best inputs we've ever had at a director's conference was last year when Gordon Brown came along, and he spoke passionately about global education and the challenge of trying to ensure, you know, that every child has the right to a primary place, and we're a long, long way off that.
Yeah.
That sounds like a really interesting charity. Can you briefly tell us a bit about that?
The background is... for quite a number of years, I chaired the Duke of Edinburgh's Award here in Scotland, and on the back of that, we were involved with some international work, and in this case, particularly in a wee country on the west of Africa called the Gambia. It's one of the smallest countries in Africa, and what we've done is we've developed a secondary school and skills training centre in one of the suburbs of the capital, and we're just completing the construction and commissioning of another one in a rural area. And schools from Scotland go out there, and it's a really life-changing experience for the Scottish kids, and they actually team up with a Gambian counterpart. And in many respects, they make friends for life, but they see another culture, and they really do see how difficult it is in Africa for many, many, many millions of people.
Yeah. That sounds fantastic. Yeah. We'll maybe get a link to any kind of websites or anything like you got for that later.
We'll do that. Yeah.
Okay. But I was quite moved by the experiences of a lot of the young teachers at the recent Strathclyde Teach Meet. And while I'm on the topic, I must thank all the colleagues from West Dunbartonshire who came to a teach meet today of our own, 35 or so of them for in about, you know, I think it must have been about 12 of them did presentations, so it was awesome. But anyway, to go back to the Strathclyde students under Amanda Corrigan's courses, Steve, remember we had her as a guest?
Yes, yeah.
And the theme was international learning, and I would say the bulk of them that night talked about their experience of going out to do voluntary work or to do exchange in either third world or developing middle European countries. And the thing that struck me is that this was a big group of people who are, you know, going to become our future teachers. And I'm not sure that the group of teachers that I was part of as a trainee had anything like that proportion of people who had shown their commitment to education by going and doing that learning. I certainly hadn't. So I was humbled. It was fantastic.
Yeah, that's right.
One girl, I think, two at the time, had talked about her work out there. Sorry, Steve, to cut across you there. But she'd been working with teachers there, volunteers and native-grown teachers, on introducing assessment for learning techniques in classes of, from memory, it was something like 250, something like that.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. No, I've just finished reading White Tiger by Aravind Adiga. It's a lovely novel, but it's kind of based on real life experiences. But it just points out the corruption at kind of very many levels of government across the world. And you know, the Indian government had a big campaign on building schools and literacy and the uniforms and what have you, but the money just gets lost, or you know, the teacher who hasn't been paid and just sits there at the front of the class doing nothing because he hasn't been paid, and the uniforms have been flogged off by somebody on route, and there's just huge sort of structural problems that have to be addressed.
Isn't it so sad when there's so much enthusiasm for learning in those countries? They really value it, don't they?
Yeah,
it's an absolute passport for them. I first experienced this in Zimbabwe, and you know, I could see youngsters, you know, 7-8 year old kids in pristine school uniform, bare feet, perhaps walking 5-6 miles to school and back, And I've obviously seen it out in the Gambia as well, and they're just, as you say, passionate for education. And actually it's something that Scottish teachers just could never imagine happening, but there are some months when the teachers don't get paid, and as far as the corruption's concerned, that's why in our particular charity we deal directly, with the school in the centre, and we make sure that all of our money is invested as it should be. So yeah, it's a real challenge. Different cultures.
Can I ask before we move off this story? I think this is another one that would make a podcast on its own, but what would you see as the way forward then, Bruce, to try and brighten up those depressing statistics that Steve spotted? Is this doable? Can we get a place for every child in the foreseeable?
There's a massive amount of support for this across the developed world, and I do think that some high profile people like Gates, for example, like Gordon Brown and his wife Sarah Brown, the Malala campaign has been quite interesting as well, what impact a teenager can have. And yeah, it's doable if we want to actually make this a priority, but therein lies the politics of international relations and all the other things. Look what's happening in Syria just now. I was lucky enough to pay a visit to Jordan in November, on holiday, if you like, sightseeing and so on. But I could see a lot of displaced Syrians there, and the plight of Syrian children is totally unacceptable just now.
Well, I guess we can't fix the world, so...
No.
But it's good at least to know that there's backing and traction for it. Maybe Gates and Negroponte and people like that will begin to get their weight behind these campaigns, we'll hope.
Don't underestimate what Scotland's done in Malawi, for example, where they've just targeted one country. But I think we could do it.
Yeah, I'd like to think so too. I guess the interesting question I'd kind of like to leave hanging is just, is it possible that technology will solve this before politics does? As I say, no need to answer. I just wonder whether, if mobile internet's not start to spread, among people that are really hungry for learning, will they start to find more of their own way of doing it anyway? However, the thing I spotted just briefly, actually very seldom does a story in the Times Educational Supplement make me, just stop in my tracks. And this week there was one, because I'm clearly out of touch. It seemed to imply in a story that Moray Council, one of our northern councils, Steve, up sort of near Inverness and out to the east, has axed the principal teacher's role. And it was a badly written article, in as much as you couldn't tell whether it was all principal teachers or primary school principal teachers. So I just thought this was a huge thing, if this is as it appeared in the article, the first example of removing a whole layer from schools. Do you know any more about this one, Bruce?
Yeah, I think it was the principal teacher role in the primary school, and I do think it is perhaps an example of some of the really difficult decisions councils are going to have to make. Obviously, the biggest single cost in running an education authority is the teacher staffing budget.
Yeah.
And I think that council, it's one of the smallest councils, I think they're finding it very, very difficult to run their service in the kind of to the high standard that they've enjoyed. I mean, I know the area pretty well. Way back earlier on in my career, I was Deputy Director of Education in Grampian, and had the privilege of having Moray as one of my responsibilities. But they're having to make difficult decisions left, right and centre as a council on spending, whether it be capital spending or, in this case, schools. They had a real difficult decision last year on the libraries, and had to close quite a number of their libraries. And I do think it's a wake-up call, Matthew, for the sort of thing that I was talking about earlier, because I know from the discussions I've been part of and party to, that if we're looking at you know, 20% in some cases of spending cuts over the next 4 years, then these will be the hard decisions that councils will have to make. And I do fear that a bit of a postcode lottery will it's beginning to appear already. So yeah, that was an interesting and sad article, I agree, in last week's Times Educational Supplement.
It's sobering, isn't it? Extremely. Yeah, I'm glad you clarified that. So from context, it did seem to be talking about primary principal teachers, but it didn't actually state that anywhere in the article except by implication. But it also said that East Lothian are looking at the same thing. They're in consultation for it just now, so it could become a thing, as they say in tech podcasts.
Yeah, I mean, earlier in my, not long after I started as director in Highland, I was invited to be an advisor to the Macron Committee, which was a real learning experience for me. And an awful lot of what's been introduced since Macron and as a consequence of Macron is being eroded, just because of these financial challenges. And that's where I was really coming from in the recent article that I put together, because it does seem to me that one should really question whether or not Moray should be a standalone education authority. That's not a reflection on Moray at all, but it's a reflection on the challenge that Moray Council has in trying to deliver education in a very dispersed area with a very small number of schools.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's one we'll obviously keep an eye on, and you know, the clear sort of paradox at the moment is that we're trying to raise standards and trying to develop a new curriculum, and you know, we're really pushing ourselves, and it's going to be difficult for staff to keep the morale up when I think it's 40 odd teachers have lost that role. Anyway, it's where we might be going if we're not able to rethink, as your article suggested. Okay, well, I guess with what remains of our time, what would be nice is to tap into your wisdom a little bit, Bruce. No pressure there, of course.
Don't tap too far.
Yeah, that becomes trepanning, doesn't it? It's a fine line. We don't intend to go there. I guess, you know, whenever we get an education director in our clutches, you know, we always like to get in and about the questions that fascinate us, like, you know, just how much influence, you know, can an education director have, you know, and what do you think are the key challenges for directors of education, and I suppose by association, you know, the middle layer that they manage?
Yeah, a director can be hugely influential, but at the same time, a director really must operate within a proper governance structure, and that is really important for all sorts of reasons. Yeah. But the leadership function, setting the vision, ensuring that there's two things there really. I mean, in Highland, for example, I was lucky to work with Peter Peacock initially when I went up there. Peter, who became a Minister of Education in Scotland, had just completed a bit of work on looking ahead for the Highlands, the vision for the Highlands. And my role really was to convert that political aspiration and vision, as far as education and cultural services were concerned, you know, convert that into policy and into reality. And that's the kind of framework that a director should operate within. The challenges, latterly, I mean, I was carrying around a budget of £250 million a year on my back, if you like, and that's a challenge. Well, it never goes away, you know, when you're spending that sort of money in a year. So you've got a whole raft of challenges, political, financial challenges, but at the same time, it's a brilliant job. It's a wonderful job, actually, and a privilege to have done it. it. But I think these days the job is a real hard core, as they would say, and particularly because of the spending cuts that are on us already. So that's why I do as much as I can to try and support my colleagues and advise them and so on. So yeah, it's a great job. It's a job actually I think should probably become a statutory function of a council. It's interesting. I don't know what the situation is, Steve, south of the border, but we don't have a statutory function of a chief education officer.
Right.
And the fact that some directors' posts are actually being removed is very worrying. That's one of the things I'd like to think that the Scottish Parliament introduces over the next few years.
Yeah, I don't know what the stats are, Bruce, but it seems that it's not just beginning to happen. That it's almost as if most directors are now joint services.
Yes, as I said, I started off as a director of education and fairly quickly had the cultural and sporting services and that, and it was brilliant. It's a good fix, actually, education, culture and sport, excellent fix. But some of them are now deputy chief executives with roles that are very, very hard roles. And in these circumstances, with the declining numbers of second and third tier officers, it's becoming anorexic to a point that I'm seriously concerned for some of my colleagues.
Yeah. Chris, just before I bring Steve in there, I see you're waiting with a question. I remember meeting you, it must be, 10 to 15 years ago, and I remember hearing you speak a couple of times as Director of Education, and you had a real buoyancy about you, if I may say. I'm sure you were burdened by your 250 million monkey on your back, but it didn't show. You told a very strong story. In fact, the reason I met you, listeners might be interested, is because you had commissioned some very forward-thinking work that I was lucky enough to get in on to talk to people about future schooling in your area. There was that real tomorrow focus going on. It was very exciting. I'm just wondering if you think that education directors have got the same freedom to set that big vision now. And I wonder, can we tie that into what you were saying about learning from down south, having a little bit more diversity, even if we are smug about some of the things that we are doing well.
Yeah, I think you make a very, very, very good point. It depends on the political circumstances and the financial circumstances of the area that you're working in. But I think it's important that if you're the principal professional advisor to a council, that you have that opportunity to advise. Now, at the end of the day, this is how democracy works, and it should work. I was just very lucky in Highland, for example, that I was able to influence in the way I did. But directors should be forward thinking and need to set out a vision, for children and young people predominantly. That piece of work you referred to is something I think we need to return to, because I think there's a danger we can get too bogged down with some of the real hard issues around resource challenges just now, and actually part of the solution there is in future thinking and doing things differently and maybe being a bit more risk-taking and innovative than we prepare to be in Scotland.
Steve?
Going back to your question about the situation down south, I'm a bit out of touch with it now, but I know in 2007, following New Labour's children's plan, the whole notion of children's and integrated children's services was obviously implemented across local authorities, which on paper, yeah, fantastic idea. I thought there was a lot in the whole notion of a children's plan. But since the department in England has separated out a lot of those other services from education, I'm not sure what the picture is. And part of the problem, where authorities...
Steve,
say what?
We just lost you for a moment there. It's okay, you seem to have come back. Sorry, as I spoke.
I come back.
No, we've lost you, Steve. I think... We'll pick up on another point for a moment while Skype stops hiccuping. I don't know what's happened there, but anyway. Bruce, I guess the obvious question that falls on while Steve's mic is recovering is, do you feel that it's getting too hard? I don't want to make it a pessimistic question, you know, because I know you'll turn it to a positive answer because it's your nature. But is it getting too hard for directors to be risk takers? Because we may have had a, or so it seems, I'm not sure you'll have a good perspective, we may have had a mounting accountability culture.
I think there is an accountability culture that's built into our system. I look at some of the challenges that we have now in terms of trying to change educational provision, for example. It does seem to me that we need to reflect on that. However, there's still plenty scope in the system for us to be innovative. If you think of two things that are really current just now. I'm a bit disappointed as to how risk averse we've been on curriculum for excellence, particularly in the senior phase. It's crying out for innovation, and in far too many schools, and I would have to say under the leadership of too many authorities, we've seen same old, same old, and that's an example. The other one is in the whole business of trying to close that attainment gap, and we've got that fixed kind of 20% of young people who are in disadvantage, who are really, really deserve our best shot, and I think actually to move that on a far more innovative approach to education and children's services preparation for life is needed. So that kind of debate, we need a bit of space and a bit of security to do that, and sometimes that can be difficult locally and nationally.
Yeah. Thanks, Bruce. Steve, are you back back with sound?
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah, it seems fine. I don't know what happened there. It seems to have been a recurring Skype issue recently. Steve, sorry, you might pick up your question again, then we'll...
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a statutory position. I'm just saying since 2007, really, with New Labour and the notion of children's services and integrated service, which has been an idea on paper. I think a lot of authorities have...
Steve, you're fading in and out. I'm so sorry.
Okay.
I don't know what the pattern is there. If you want to have a wee footer with the cables and see what's happening.
No.
Sorry, Bruce.
It's all right.
I suppose another interesting question about that is about the personalities themselves. And of course, that's not something that we would ever get into on a person-by-person basis. But, is there a challenge for directorship? We have often thought as people in my kind of middle tier, central leadership and councils have done. What would I be like as a director? I'm not sure I would ever have it in me. Is there a challenge in that accountability culture means that we tend to promote a certain kind of person, and it may not be the kind of person who is a risk taker?
Yeah, it's quite interesting to see how all of that has evolved. When I went into, I worked in schools for 17 years before I even thought about, going into the office, as it was called then. And what I essentially did was I had to learn a different job, and I was very, very lucky to work alongside some really inspirational guys, but also guys who just knew the job. I think these days there are a lot of people who maybe come straight out of a school into a very senior position, and there are aspects of the job that are very, very, very different, and they need a bit of time and a bit of space just to learn the job, and that's not always given to them. And that's where I think back to this whole business of the middle tier. I think I'd like to see a far more joined up middle tier across Scotland. We're a small country, so I'd like, for example, to see the Scottish Government policy teams and the Education Scotland improvement government teams and the local authority teams working far more collaboratively than they are, and I think we'll get far more for the system out of that. But yeah, it's it can be a hard job, but it's an absolutely brilliant, rewarding job. And the one thing I used to look back on if I was having a pretty bad week or whatever, and you do get bad weeks as well, you know, but it's about, you know, visiting a school and just seeing what it's all about. And I was talking to a director recently on that, and she was saying that her husband knows when she's been visiting a school. She comes home buoyant. That's interesting, isn't it?
Very interesting, yeah. Well, we're getting near the end of the podcast, but Steve, are we going to try this again?
Well, yeah, and then give up. I think it was, I think the local authorities have about 200.
Oh, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. Steve, you're gone again. There's some weird predictable thing. As soon as you start speaking, it just fades out. Oh, well. Steve, you're gone completely. Anyway, I think, Bruce, have you got any last thoughts on the topic tonight? Poor Steve, he must be so frustrated there. That's just awful when this happens. Any last thoughts you want to kind of, you know...
I think the one thing I would want to leave us with is, look, yeah, there's challenges and so on out there just now, particularly around the financial climate, but hey, what a brilliant job people are doing the length and breadth of Scotland, and we've got some fantastic children. I've just this week alone seen some brilliant practice around literacy developments, for example, one in your own authority, actually, Matthew. And
good to hear these plugs for WDC. Yeah, I never sorry to hear this.
But let's be upbeat as well. There's some great work going on, and despite the financial challenges, we are still pouring millions and millions into the system. Let's get, you know, the best use out of that for our young people, because fundamentally Scotland's future will depend on them.
Absolutely. Well, you almost sound like a man that's talking himself into a third term of directorship, but it's been really good to get your perspective, and good to chew the fat over the news as well, Bruce. It's been very enjoyable. Steve,
you're very welcome. Thanks again.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Steve, are you able to get a last word in?
Well, only just as...
No. We'll do a technical post-mortem on this one, Steve, and see if we can figure it. But I'm sure Steve was going to say thanks. Yeah. Okay. Well, Bruce, join us again sometime soon if you can. It's been a real pleasure. So, good night.
All best.